being cautioned, getting a criminal record of 15 for petty crime, up to no good.
What were you doing?
I was drinking, drunk and disorderly. I'm ashamed to say. But no, I'm not proud of that. But what it did teach me was a great lesson. I can remember very clearly, I was on the park one night, mouthing off to a police officer, thinking I was a bit of a Jack the Lad in front of my friends. And then 12 hours later, I'm sat in a police cell, 15 years old, on my 15th birthday. And I remember crying my eyes out at 3 o'clock in the morning, sobered up, thinking, what am I doing here? But I remember also making a pledge to myself that day, that saying that I never want to end up in one of these places ever again.
Yeah.
And touch wood, I never will, and I haven't done so far. But I think that was probably the first real lesson I learned, because it was from there I realised that I didn't want to be in that life, the life that I would have very easily slipped into, as did a lot of family members, cousins and things. And my father was in the Royal Marines. He had a career in the Royal Marines, and he didn't sort of force me or even pressure me in any way. He just said, maybe look at the military. And I was terrible at school as well. I was a sports person. I played football, athletics, cricket, basketball. And as long as I was doing something sporty, I really didn't care for anything academic or academia. And that was probably a reflection of me not getting any GCSEs at the time, unfortunately.
Well, that's not, academia isn't for everyone. And I think everyone's pushed that way, aren't they?
They are, but it is important. And I want to, ironically, I go into schools every day of the week now, and I tell people how important it is to not that academia is important, but giving 110% in anything you do.
Yeah.
And actually taking the opportunities that are presented to you. And I think when I've travelled the world and seen in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, that children don't even get education, it made me realise later in life that I was very lucky to be presented with the opportunities of teachers who wanted to help me develop and grow. With the Somali pirate boarding our ship was a couple of years later, but my first job was certainly getting on. But it was a phone call one day from a Royal Marine friend of mine who'd just left, and he said, Jordan, we need an extra guy to jump on this ship. It's armed security. We're protecting.
Right. So you went straight. You went
literally
into armed security.
Yeah, straight away. It was an opportunity, and it was when you're in the military and you see all these privateers who are doing these jobs that look really cool, really sexy, and they're getting paid loads of money for it. It was sort of like looking at it like it was a James Bond type lifestyle.
But you sound like a James Bond. Reading about you. I mean, you literally in this kidnap situation, and you actually, it was down to you that saved the crew.
Yeah, it was, I'd done up and down the Somali coast for a couple of years, protecting ships from pirate attacks. And a lot of people don't realise that 95% of world trade is still done on the ocean. So, the coffee we drink, the clothing we wear, the electronics in our homes, the phones, the wine, it's all coming on a ship at some point in its life cycle. And for me, it was quite fascinating because these people who control these ships and crew these ships, they're sort of unsung heroes of society, because we just take for granted that our food's going to be on the table or in the supermarket.
We don't even think that all the oil, the gas,
the energy in the world is coming across the ocean. But it's only when you sort of go there firsthand and see these incredible people who work at sea for 10 out of 12 months a year are bringing us our goods every day. And the only reason they can do that is if they're being protected, because they've got to get there securely. And our job was literally to be an armed security lookout. And pirates were hijacking these ships. And to give you some sort of scale of context, in 2011, in July 2011, there was more than 1,000 seafarers, so people who work on the ships, held hostage by pirates, and more than 40 big commercial tankers held in captivity in Somali ports. As I say, our job was to protect those crews, the cargo, the ship itself. And then, unfortunately, on one occasion, I was the security team leader, and the security company said, Jordan, we need you to take this vessel down to Somalia. And we were doing it for the World Food Programme, so we were literally delivering international aid, so rice and grain.
So it was aid as well.
Yeah,
it wasn't like the coffee that you drink.
It was for people, there was a famine crisis in Somalia. And unfortunately, we weren't allowed to carry weapons on this particular job, because every ship in the world has a flag on the back of it. And whatever flag that is means the laws of that land are applicable to that ship. So every ship is like a bit of territory or a bit of that country floating around the ocean. And the same laws apply, like they would, you can't walk through the streets of London with a gun. So you can't stand on a British flagged ship with a gun in your pocket. Yeah. So we took a job, me and my security team.
So you'd been American, eh?
Big machine gun. So we took this job, and we knew it was risky. And obviously our pay was reflected in that. And we took it down to Somalia, and the idea was we would be there for a couple of hours. We would drop off the cargo, and then we would shoot across the Indian Ocean and get out of the sort of danger zone. But unfortunately, as with international logistics and shipping, delays happen, which is quite common. And what should have been a few hours became a day, became days, became a week, and so forth. And we were hit by the pirates. And I can remember very clearly my 2IC, my second in command, who was on the bridge, the sort of command station of the ship. And he said, I was in my cabin, and he got on the radio and he said, Jordan, get up to the bridge now. We've got armed pirates climbing on board the ship. And as you can imagine what I thought at that point. So ran up to the bridge I saw exactly what he had described. So obviously that was where we earn our money as a security team. We have to manage.
Do you live for that moment? Is there a bit of a...
No, absolutely not. No, I'm not looking for that moment.
It's not like you're going shark diving and you see your first shark.
No, I'm not. As a security professional, the misconception is, yeah, we live for that. We don't. We're trying to avoid trouble at all costs. Mm. You know, we're there to make sure that everything goes smoothly. So we try and manage the risk accordingly. But in this situation, the drill is, or the procedure is that we, a bit like a fire drill, you would get everybody in a safe location and you account for everybody and muster the crew together. And then you would wait for somebody to come and support you or rescue you. In this case, the special forces in the region or the Navy. And so what we did is we went down to what we call a citadel, which is a safe room or a panic room in the bottom right in the depths of the engine room of the ship. We secured ourselves in behind lots of metal barriers. And we were in there, and as you can imagine, it's very heated. People are stressed. People think they're going to die. Yeah. And there was a lot of emotion. We disabled the engines. We turned off all the lights to try and confuse the pirates. But we always knew that the pirates were trying to find us and get their way to us so they could kidnap and have this hostage scenario where they would then be able to ransom us for a fee. And obviously, as a security team, ex-British military, we'd be the prime target, you know, because we'd be a lot higher value as a Western former military target. And it was a mixed nationality crew, lots of different nationalities in that crew of about 22 people. And I got down there, we accounted for everybody. The captain was saying, okay, Jordan, what are we going to do now? And so the job for me was then to call in a rescue. So I went to the satellite phone in the citadel. And unfortunately, it didn't work, a bit like on our mobile phones. There was no signal. We're in a black spot in the ocean.
Damn.
Yeah. And we tested that phone every day as well. So it was sod's law, really, you know, that it didn't work when we needed it to. And to be very honest, that the satellite phone and the
just
rescue...
Just imagine the scene of you going, can you get it? Can you get it?
literally what it was like. And as you can imagine, that was the plan B. There wasn't a plan C, D and E. The plan B is we go to the safe room, the citadel, and we call in a rescue and we wait for the rescue. So we're in there, we've got no communications with the outside world, and unfortunately, if you can't tell anyone you're there, nobody's coming to rescue you. And at the same time, pirates are trying to make progress to find you, so the clock is always ticking. And the pirates know that, because the pirates know that as soon as they get on that vessel, we've probably called a rescue, so their time is ticking as well. So they're working as fast and as hard as they can, sort of tactically. And I had some really heated debates with the captain, because when you're in the safe room, the citadel, you don't leave the citadel, because what we have then is a potential hostage situation. If I'd leave the citadel, the pirates get a hold of me, they put a gun to my head and they say, everybody come out now, he's getting the good news. And also, if there was a hostage situation, the special forces would never board our vessel to try and rescue us, because they know that someone would probably get killed. You know, the movies show us that.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So the problem was, is there was, what do we do? And I had to say to the captain, I said, sir, you know, I need to take that phone and I need to go outside and leave the citadel. And of course, he was very anti this idea. He told me what he thought in quite an aggressive manner. But I also sort of tried to hold my ground and say, yeah, but there is no plan C, D and E now. If we don't do this, the likelihood is we will die in here, because the pirates are on board. We've got no food. We've got no water left.
And who was the most senior in that situation?
The captain's still the most senior.
Yeah,
he's the boss on the ship. We're just, even as the team leader, I'm only a consultant advisor. I tell him the best practice. But obviously the captain hasn't been in hostile environments. You know, I spent 20 years in places like Iraq and so on, where, you know, people are being shot at, people have been killed. And I think all that sort of experience allows you to make calculated decisions based on the risks and the threats. And for me, I had to leave that citadel, because there was no other way we were going to get rescued. And in the end, we come to, after a heated debate, and also one of my own teammates who was former British military, he didn't want me to leave the citadel as well. So, one of them was supporting me and one of them was against. So But it was really tough and really stressful, and one of the, you know, probably definitely the scariest moment or the most nervous or apprehensive moment of my life, because I was going into the unknown. And I think, you know, that's quite...
What made you make that decision that you wanted to put your life for everybody else? Because I guess you could have just sat there and thought, okay, I'm going to see this through like everybody else. But you're stepping up to the mark and saying, we can't just sit here and do nothing. What was that?
I don't know. I think I was a team leader, so my position, I took responsibility for, I believed I had the experience. I think there are lots of times in life when you can break the rules. You know, I think if we look at all the pioneers of society, the entrepreneurs, the game changers, yeah. the Steve Jobs, yeah. the Bransons, these are
disruptors,
all people.
Yeah.
Yeah, the disruptors. These are all people who have gone against the grain, gone in a different direction yeah. when society conforms to this way, and they've gone a different way. And I think that is often where you find opportunity, where the magic happens. But you can only do that if you've got the experience. Otherwise, it becomes reckless. And I felt I had the experience to make that decision. I also knew that I had a daughter at home that I wanted to see again. Yeah. So for me, I wasn't going to die on that ship. And I certainly wasn't. I was going to try my best to make sure we all went home safely, because that was my job. And, you know, that was what I'd been trained to do. I find that for me, you know, I was diagnosed with severe depression, chronic anxiety. And for me, it's never been about the bombs and the bullets and the hardships of conflict and war. For me, that's been about the stuff that happens to all of us in everyday life. Relationship breaks down, not seeing my daughter or family enough. I think they're the real challenges that a lot of people have. For me personally, I find that running is a great way to deal with mental health. Not just running, but exercise. Yeah. You know, going for a walk in the park. We've got these incredible, beautiful, natural national parks all around us.
Richmond Park. Richmond, I was there this morning. Walking is beautiful. Yeah. It's like my meditation zone.
And that's what I mean. And I think a bit of running, a bit of light exercise, walking every day, even if it's just 30 minutes or so, is so good for the mind, for the soul. And I knew that running was good, but I wanted to push running to the next level. And actually, me going to these countries for a few weeks or a few months is not much in relation to children who live there every day in fear of their life. So I think also it's about shining a spotlight on the problem.
Yeah.
So as well as fundraising and raising awareness, we need to show people what the problem is, which is when I did the rowing, the world first row, that was about showing people the problem of Yemen, which is why I rowed to Yemen and back.
And sorry, this is just touching on that. Well, not touching on that. This is just the challenge that you've just done.
Yeah, yeah.
And you rowed the most dangerous strait of water, basically, on the planet.
Yeah.
Why?
No, it was, you know, it was a bit of a crazy idea, I guess, in some respects from the outside. But again, it was about shining a spotlight on this incredible humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where there's hundreds, thousands of children dying every year from conflict and war. And for me, I want, again, to get the coverage you need to do things that attract significant attention and a world first. World firsts are hard to find in this day and age, because a lot of people have done a lot of things. And normally, if it's not been done, there's normally a good reason why it's not been done, which was obviously the case in this one. But again, it was about showing people that you can achieve anything as well, because also at the same time, I'd never rowed a boat in my life before the 1st of January. So I trained with...
Never rowed. Literally, you're getting in there and presumably these are the most dangerous straits. You're going to have to row pretty fast.
Well, I trained for 10 months with a gentleman called Alex Gregory, who was a double Olympic gold champion rower in Rio and London 2012, 2016. And he got me in the shape. And I think even he couldn't believe when I got in the boat and I'd never rowed and I was getting in the wrong way around and that. He was like, going around in circles. But I had an incredible team. Yes, I did the row, but I had an incredible team of support, training, logistics, communications, insurance. Lots of people contributed. And again, as we say, you can't do anything great alone. And that was a huge team effort by a lot of people. And it was just me who went and did the row. I genuinely believe that social media is probably responsible, accountable for a lot of the mental health issues in young people. I think things like, you know, even when we post a photo these days, it has to go through 5-6 filters before we put the actual picture on. It's incredible. So we live in a world where we're constantly comparing ourselves.
Right? Well,
it's not real. It's a fantasy world. Yeah. I always think social media is like a showreel of highlights of people's lives, you know, because we only show the best bits. We don't show the bad days as such. For me, you know, my big passion is to inspire the next generation, and I'm fearful that we're not getting it right. I think this celebrity culture that is coming about now, where people are famous for being famous. They've not even done anything. You know, when I go and talk in assemblies in schools and people tell me, what do you want to do when you're older? And they say, I want to be an Insta model. I want to be famous. I want to be a celebrity. And
be
I'm
on
like,
TV.
Yeah, I want to be
well,
on TV.
Well, I'll be YouTube now. Not
yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's what I mean. I think there's this culture now where we've got these influencers who have got millions of followers, but it comes with no responsibility. And I think if you are an influencer in any sector, you need to be accountable for what you post, your actions, because a lot of people, whether you like it or not, are looking up to you. So you need to be sending out positive messages, encouraging, inspiring, motivating, not, you know, what's going on Love Island or with respect to the Love Islanders. Yeah. But you know what I mean? You know, I think we need more role models for the right reasons, because it concerns me and it scares me, actually, of where the world's going in that context.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, there's a new interview out every Monday, so hit subscribe and like, and you'll get it straight into your inbox.